It's philosophy talk.
Two people with a heart in between them.
Scary long-nosed devil face. Lipstick, high heels, flexed bicep.
Two little dancing girls wearing cat ears.
Is texting destroying the sentence?
Shouldn't we have seen the writing on the wall when the OED chose an emoji as its word of the year?
Adult woman face. Pointy finger, A-OK hand. Offensive racial stereotype. So, little angel boy.
Should we be worried about how informal language is becoming in the age of the internet?
Text bubble. Wedding ring. Scissors.
Walking man. Offensive racial stereotype. Cancer. Astrological sign. Adult woman face.
Paranoid evil monkey.
Angry face.
Are writing standards getting worse, or are they just changing with the time?
Our guest is Jan Miskowski from Reed College, author of Crises of the Sentence.
Two little dancing girls wearing cat ears and knife!
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Coming soon, it's our annual Dionysus Award show.
We'll be talking about the most philosophical movies of the past year, and we want to hear from you.
Submit your nominations to comments@philosophytalk.org and tell us why you think your movie deserves the Dionysus Award.
Are tweeting and texting killing the sentence?
Don't outmoded forms of writing deserve to die?
Isn't there room for more than one kind of writing?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming at you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about the death of the sentence. In an age of emojis, memes, and reaction GIFs, are complete sentences becoming passé?
Passé, Ray? Oh, gosh, I don't think so, and I really hope not.
Well, maybe you're just out of touch. Kids these days are creating all kinds of new forms of communication, and it's really cool.
Well, look, I'm not here to bash the youth of today. I mean, I think they're fantastic. They're politically active, they're resourceful, they're forward-looking. But, you know, if they can't use complete sentences, what are their essays going to look like?
Oh, come on, Josh. Why are you so invested in these conservative, outmoded ideas about writing anyway? Well, you should be encouraging creativity.
Creativity, sure. I mean, they should definitely be creative in their ideas. But once they've got those ideas, well, what's wrong with putting them down in the form of sentences and making an essay out of it? So, you know, saying things clearly so we can all understand them.
Oh, geez, that's so narrow. Why not encourage them to create word clouds or computer programs or like collections of images, something like that?
Well, because I want them to express complete thoughts, Ray, and I want them to organize those thoughts in a way that makes sense to another human being.
Well, okay, sure, but like, why do you need a whole essay to do that? You could express a complete thought in just a few words.
Oh, yeah? How?
Aha! See, you did it right there when you said, oh, yeah, how? You expressed a complete thought.
That wasn't a complete thought.
Well, gee, Josh, I understood you, didn't I?
Yes, okay, you did understand me, but only because I was responding to your half of the conversation. I mean, if you took those words, oh, yeah, how, and like, put them in a different context, they mean something completely different. I could use them to ask how, I don't know, how lasers work, or how the presidential election's going to turn out, or I don't know, how to make a nice English trifle.
Well, yeah, of course, if you take someone's words out of context, you can change the meaning. But isn't that just as true of a passage from an essay as it is for a sentence fragment or a series of GIFs?
Look, I really don't think so. After all, look, a GIF can have multiple interpretations. Some people even call them a GIF. Right? But a well-formed sentence, Ray, that's going to be easy to understand.
A well-formed sentence. Oh, here, what about this one? Wherefore art thou Romeo? That's a well-formed sentence, but people misunderstand it all the time. They think wherefore means where, but it really means why.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. You got me, and you kind of got me on my own home turf. So, okay. Points to you. But I still want to say about that, you know, that's a 400-year-old play. I feel like people are going to have an easier time understanding things that have been written today.
Oh, so you do like contemporary language. I'm so glad you're a fan of GIFs and emojis after all.
Wait, you're calling GIFs and emojis language?
Old man yells at cloud, Josh.
Angry face emoji, Ray.
Hashtag get off my lawn. But seriously, emojis are a language, just like written English.
I don't get it. How's that supposed to work?
Ha, I'm so glad you asked. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to investigate the creative potential of emojis. She files this report.
Marcel Denese is like the smiling face with the sunglasses emoji. He's chill.
I send text messages, and I had a rock and roll band, don't get me wrong.
Denese teaches semiotics at the University of Toronto, so naturally he was once in a band called the Semiotones. One member of the Semiotones always ended her text with a smiley face, until one day...
She sent me a text that it was not there, and I started to panic. I said, oh my God, something is going on in her life.
Denese called her to find out what was going on. Sure enough, she was having a bad day. The absence of the smiley face said it all.
I knew right there and then that this is a very powerful new form that is emotive and communicatively powerful. It moved me to call her up.
Text, emails, and emojis might seem like they're making us lazy writers. But over time, very specific rules developed. Like if you don't use multiple exclamation points or throw in a smiley face, something might be wrong. Emojis bring warmth and tone to electronic communication.
Even if it's ironic and so on, in the end, smile, laugh it off, life is too short. I don't know if I can say this on American program, but your president does not use them.
I know words, I have the best words.
There are other unspoken guidelines too. You might say LOL ironically after something terrible happened, or you might use capital letters or periods to show you're angry.
So if you send someone sounds good with no period, then that's kind of this sort of flat or default intonation.
Gretchen McCulloch is the author of Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language.
But if you send someone sounds good with a period, it sounds kind of like sounds good.
McCulloch says, like speaking, writing now has formal and informal versions, but that doesn't mean the internet will kill off the formal sentence.
You know, you talk differently to your dog than you do to your boss, or at least I hope so. And that doesn't mean that informality is a bad thing.
Emojis bring facial expressions to a faceless online world, but they can't replace words.
Let's play Emojinius.
It's difficult to understand emoji sequences. There's even a show called Emojinius where contestants try.
Welcome to Emojinius, the show where solving emoji messages will earn one team a shot at $10,000.
In this segment, contestants must identify the band expressed through emojis. A white square album, Park Ranger and Pepper emoji appear on the screen.
Go.
Blank, white,
armies,
white,
army soldier, Red Hot Chili Peppers!
No, that's not it.
The answer was the White Album and Sgt. Pepper. Next, there's an image of four Beetle emojis.
Spider-Man!
Oh my gosh!
Oh, God.
The Beatles, that was the correct answer.
And emojis aren't so great for expressing complex ideas. A group of people even tried writing Moby Dick entirely in emojis. But it's impossible to read without the text, just a sample.
Telephone, man with mustache, sailboat, whale, okay sign.
That means call me Ishmael.
5X, nostril, chart increasing with yen, question mark, muscle, sunflower.
And that means it is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. But then again, Herman Melville made up a lot of words when he wrote Moby Dick. Some scholars say that's because the English vocabulary was too limiting for what he wanted to say. Imagine then what Melville himself could have done with emojis.
Why are you wearing that long face? Are you not game for Moby Dick?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thumbs up, smiley face, Holly. You definitely have some of the best words. Thanks for that great report. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're asking about the death of the sentence.
We're joined now by Jan Miskowski, professor of German and comparative literature at Reed College and the author of Crises of the Sentence. Jan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jan, what first got you interested in the subject of sentences and changes in the sentences? I mean, did you have some kind of dangerously bad text exchange? What happened?
I guess everybody's had some dangerously bad text exchanges, but my interest began when I was very young, actually. My mother used to recite texts to me in languages that I only understood a part of, or in some cases didn't know any of the words at all. But what was already clear to me as a child was simply from the rhythm and the structure of the sentences of what she was saying, one could understand quite a lot. And so to this day, even when I'm going to write a sentence, as much as I, like everyone else, am looking for the best adjective to modify the noun and so forth, I'm also trying to realize a certain kind of rhythm. And that was the first way, as I say, in these experiences with my mother, that I started thinking about the different elements of sentences and how it's actually quite a complex dynamic.
Oh, so clearly today the internet is changing the rhythm of the way we use language and the way we and the way we write and talk. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think that language always changes. I think at certain times, certain aspects of it change at different speeds than others. I think what's different about the internet and the kinds of communities you have on social media platforms is that in a certain sense, groups of people are actively watching these changes in a self-conscious way, possibly in contradistinction to the past.
That's interesting. So people actually comment on how things are changing.
I think a lot of the conversation about the changes in the language is inextricably bound up in the commentary on it. Even since we were talking earlier, the report about emojis, I think it's very rare that somebody uses an emoji in an entirely non-ironic way. In other words, there's nothing natural about the emoji. The emoji is deployed in a very self-conscious fashion, and that can make it very complicated to understand because there can be multiple levels of irony involved. Mm. But it's the awareness of this. It's the fact that the sense of the language being in a kind of volatile state is an explicit theme that people are grappling with all the time.
Do you think that commentary actually feeds back and changes the way that people use language when they're not talking about language?
Absolutely. I think that distinction, in fact, is somewhat blurry. In other words, there's a certain sense in which you're always thinking about how you're using the language as you're using the language. But I think it definitely permeates other platforms, as the kids would say.
That makes perfect sense. Something I've been thinking a lot about is, why is it so fun to use? It's not unprecedented. Obviously, we've had slang for a very long time. There's always new ways of doing things. But maybe is that part of the fun? You've always got a choice. You could send a text message that spells everything out in words, or you could send an emoji or a string of emoji. Why is the latter more fun? Is it partly because of the irony you're talking about? It's all very self-aware.
I think there's also a sense of the rules being loosened, and one feels one has a license to a certain kind of creativity that one maybe doesn't have in grammar school when you're told don't, under any circumstances, write something that might even vaguely resemble a fragment and so forth. I think it's also, to a certain extent, for the younger generation, it's empowering to see that even older people are experimenting in new ways. So I know some very accomplished professionals who write emails that don't have a single capital letter or punctuation mark ever. In some cases, they've been doing this for decades. And when I first saw this, I was appalled. But I've gradually come to appreciate it as a kind of, as I say, a kind of experimentation and a kind of loosening of the rules that I think is ultimately productive.
I know that you, Jan, and actually you, Josh, too, enjoy using Twitter. And I'm curious if you think that there are sort of special things that Twitter enables you to do that other kinds of language use don't.
Well, the fascinating thing about Twitter is that it takes the basic conceit of the internet and turns it on its head. And what I mean by this is the internet, there's infinite space. In other words, if you want your blog to be a million words long, your blog can be a million words long. You don't run out of ink, you don't run out of paper. Twitter takes that and reverses it and says, okay, we're going to give you virtually no space. You have to work within these very precise length constraints. And I think that's a very interesting parameter. In that regard, Twitter is in certain respects very conventional. It's something you might have once done in a poetry class where you were told to write with so many syllables per line, or you were told to write a certain kind of verse. In other words, Twitter is very formal. It gives you a precise form and says work within that. And there's nothing, as I say, there's nothing unusual about that. Historically speaking, that would be part of a very conventional kind of language experimentation.
It raises an interesting question about language change that we're talking about. I mean, because you might think, hooray for breaking down the sentence and getting creativity in and, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. But you might also say, well, you know what? Constraints are sometimes generative, right? In the same way that the Twitter constraint is generative. Why don't we, maybe the sentence form is generative too.
Absolutely. And I would say to anybody who's afraid that the sentence is dead that reports of its demise are indeed grossly exaggerated. I think with this sentence, the rules, in a certain sense, are there to be broken. I mean, they are quite resilient. No matter how many times the rules are broken, the sentence still persists. But a certain amount, as you say, there is something generative about breaking the rules. Yeah. And that's what writers and speakers have always done. There's nothing new about that.
Right, and if you don't have that background stability, the departures aren't really going to stand out. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the death of the sentence with Jan Mieszkowski from Reed College.
Is the sentence on its way out? Or will it always play an important role? And should we even care about keeping formal language alive?
Memes, emojis, and meaning in the age of the internet. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. In the age of texts and tweets, are sentences still the best way of talking loud and clear? I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about the death of the sentence. Our guest is Jan Mieszkowski from Reed College, who's the author of Crises of the Sentence.
So Jan, earlier on we were talking about new forms of communication and how they're maybe undermining formal language in certain areas, but look at the three of us. We're talking in complete sentences like old conservative fools that we are. So is, in fact, the death of the sentence greatly exaggerated, as you were saying before the break?
Well, I was thinking that in the 1990s, people were saying that students had become visual learners because they'd grown up with television and various sort of pictographic media, and that they were no longer reading in the same way that prior generations had. And whether or not that was true, and I think a lot of people were skeptical about that at the time, the advent of the internet and social media has sort of resoundingly put that to rest, because whatever you want to say about social media, it encourages an enormous amount in the way of verbal productivity. I think there are more people writing more sentences more of the time than probably ever before. And I think, so when you actually scour the internet, as it were, of course you find all sorts of experimental forms and codes and whatnot. But at the same time, you find this outpouring of very traditional in certain respects, but extremely lively, extremely energetic prose.
So that does seem true, but also it's now possible to transmit a lot of video and images on the internet in a way that it wasn't maybe like in the 90s. Do you think that that's having an effect on the way people think and write? I'll leave it there.
Well, absolutely. I think it's much more common for people to think about a kind of mixture of verbal and the visual. And as we know, I mean, 7-year-olds who have a facility with certain kinds of software can probably do this with greater dexterity than any of us can. So it's increasingly becoming a normal skill that one grows up with, that one, in a certain way, is a kind of audiovisual engineer in a fashion that would have been inconceivable 15, 20, or 30 years ago. But again, I think that's sort of on the side of creativity, of new possibilities. It doesn't necessarily dismantle old forms as much as it means that people have strengths in certain areas that previously would have been, the purview of a couple of media artists or something like that.
That seems reasonable. And, basically, I'm a person who not only loves using these things myself, but in general thinks, gosh, what a fun array of additional tools to have in the toolkit. But for the sake of argument, let me push back just a little bit, right? I think about something that Nietzsche said over 100 years ago, which, in a way makes me think we've always been having this debate, right? He was complaining that in the late 19th century already, as he put it, life no longer dwells in the whole. The word becomes sovereign and leaps out of the sentence. The sentence reaches out and obscures the meaning of the page, right? So he was saying, people aren't capable anymore of forming complete, lengthy thoughts, right? A whole argument, or taking in a whole argument, reading a whole book and understanding it. And instead, they just want to focus, instead of on the book, they want to focus on the page. Instead of on the page, they want to focus on the sentence. Instead of on the sentence, they want to focus on the word. Don't you think that could be a worry if, in this age of decreasing attention span, that people want to read tweets instead of reading books and things like that? Don't you think there's some argument to be made there?
Well, as I understand it empirically, and you should correct me on this potentially, as I understand it, people are reading more books than ever before. So I don't actually think that book sales per se have plummeted with the rise of Twitter and so forth. That said, I'm not sure, you know, when you go on Twitter, Josh, how many tweets do you read in a row? Do you actually scroll through the thread consuming tweets, or you just sort of pop in and out, as it were?
Well, it depends, right? I'm an old-fashioned person, so I will read somebody's thread. I know there are people who think threads defeat the entire purpose of Twitter, which is to say what you have to say in 280 characters and get out, you know? So I think it depends. I do worry sometimes about this sort of interest in, you know, there's something actually you talk about interestingly in your book, that there's this sort of choice point that writers have and readers have too, right? So a writer might think to themselves, I'm going to write a great book, right, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and you need to read that whole book. Or they might think to themselves, I'm going to write a book with a few great sentences that are going to go viral, right? And so that seems like an interesting dichotomy.
No, that is a very interesting point, and a number of people have said, particularly about contemporary fiction, that we live in an age of sentence fetishism. That is to say, what we regard as a great novelist is not necessarily someone who has the most exciting plot, but somebody who writes great sentences. And that is, for the reasons I think you're suggesting, that is a very odd notion, the ideal that one would simply pile up an enormous list of great sentences, and that would count as a great book, is kind of a curious thing.
I want to ask a little bit more about these sentences leaping out and strangling books, which seems like a very dramatic way to put it. So one of the things that seems really common on the internet is the ability to take a quote out of context and like screenshot it, or take a passage from a book that's a famous quote and take it out of context and screenshot it. Do you think that changes its meaning?
Well, I think it's even worse than that. I think a large percentage of the quotes that are circulated on the internet that are attributed to various famous people are actually misattributions.
That's true.
And
you know who said
I'll
that?
Go,
Einstein.
I'll go one step further. I believe I may be guilty of having disseminated false quotations. And by that I mean simply if you tweet, for example, a quotation and you attribute it to Einstein, what will happen is various quote bots will pick that up and it will become amalgamated with other quote-unquote Einstein tweets. So the possibility for inadvertently generating misinformation this way is great. And because there are literally dozens or maybe even hundreds of these quotation bots that are always trolling the internet for this information, you can create a lot of chaos inadvertently rather quickly.
I'm not blaming you, Jan.
Well, notice I didn't specify which thinker I actually did this with, so it's, I have to go hunt that down.
Okay. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the death of the sentence with Jan Miskowski from Reed College. And we've got Peter from San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Peter. What's your comment or question?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. So I'm a teacher and an author, and I feel like the death of the sentence is having a harsh effect on children and their ability to write and articulate their thoughts in complete sentences. They're having difficulty, I've noticed, in using correct grammar, punctuation, capitalization, and also they don't seem terribly enthusiastic about learning how to write and even read. It seems like more of a chore than a way to communicate their thoughts.
This is great. Thank you so much for that call, Peter. You know, it's something I've been thinking about, Jan, in relation to these sentences, that obviously part of the question is about writing and speaking, but part of it's also about thinking, right? Peter said it's not just about writing sentences, it's about thinking in sentences. I sometimes wonder whether there may have been this kind of feedback loop when literacy entered the world, when people started writing, that, you know, it made possible more complex sentences, right? Once you have writing, you can produce and then receive more complex sentences. And maybe that, in turn, helps us to get habituated to thinking in more complex sort of thought patterns, right? If we allow the sentence to degrade, let's assume it's degradation, are we in danger of affecting people's capacity for complex thought?
Absolutely, I agree entirely. In fact, I don't know if this is a step further, but I would say, I always tell my students, until you've actually tried to write your ideas down, you haven't thought through them at all. In other words, thinking and writing out one's thoughts are in some sense the same process. So if you really were to posit a situation where people weren't able to write sentences in a sophisticated way anymore, that would be horrific for the possibilities of thought. I haven't seen quite as sort of dire a situation as the caller was describing, but I do think it's very important, say for him as an educator, it's very important for him to be clear to his students why certain standards of writing are important. And because I think this is one of the most difficult problems with writing and writing style debates in general is that it's not always very clear where our models come from, right? In other words, if a teacher tells you, well, you're not writing correctly, as a student, this was always my question, was, well, what's the model? What should I be emulating? And so I guess to the caller, I would say it would be helpful if you could give the students examples of the kind of writing you want them to be doing. And I'm sure he's doing that, obviously.
Do you think the models that we should have for our writing ought to be changing as our world changes?
Well, I think that they necessarily do change. In other words, part of the internet and this media phenomenon that we're talking about is that we're not totally in control of what the models are. And sometimes, of course, the models come out of left field. You know, suddenly you have, say, a president who has a very particular relationship to the language that becomes a model for certain kinds of expression or a kind of anti-model. I think also we're always going to have multiple models, right? I mean, journalism, reading the newspaper is always going to be a different model than reading so-called long-form texts or scholarly essays or fiction and so forth. So you're always going to be juggling models. I think you just need to be self-conscious about what authority you're according the different models.
We have another caller on the line. It's Mark from Millbrae. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark. What's your question or comment?
I believe that modern-day society, and especially the modern-day generation, is gravitating more towards truncation and condensing of thought and emotions, and that the ability to express one's thoughts in a verbal way or a written way has basically gone the way of the dodo bird. I mean, you have Twitter, which only allows you so many syllables or letters to form a concise and complete thought, that instant gratification seemingly has gravitated and placed its ugly fingerprint into today's society, where the ability to converse and engage in conversation is a lost art. It's a lost art.
So Jan, truncation, what do?
You know, I appreciate the caller's sentiment, and I believe there's certainly evidence for what he's describing. But at the same time, I can't help but think of an example. I had a student a number of years ago who told me that they texted every thought they had. And I did, of course, a double take, and I said, what are you possibly talking about? And they said, well, in the course of the day, I have thoughts, and I text them. And interestingly, my next question was, well, to whom do you text all these thoughts? And they said, well, I have a whole array of friends or acquaintances that receive these texts. And I said, so how many texts is that per day? 1,000, 1,200. Wow. So here was somebody whose relationship to these changing media was quite literally a kind of text diary, but a diary of a bizarre form where every quote-unquote thought one had to be put out in writing. And that's, of course, an extreme example, for the other end of the spectrum, as it were. But I don't know that there isn't an element of that for everybody. That is to say, precisely as Josh was saying, this sort of interdependence of thinking and writing, I'm not sure we're doing so horribly on that front, given the various pressures that we're talking about.
We got an email that's exactly on this point. It's Joanne from San Francisco, and she says the following. I've taught courses at the college level, and I'm appalled at the lack of good grammar used in reports and essays written by most students. I'm wondering how this happened. Have high school teachers and college professors become lazy about insisting on good grammar and sentence structure? So maybe I can put this together a little bit with what Mark was saying earlier, because, you know, I think the three of us, I take it all agree that it's wonderful to have different strings to one's bow, right? It's wonderful to be able to do the informal thing and have fun with it and be creative. But, you know, sometimes it's also good to put on your Sunday best and marshal a good argument and be clear and powerful and everything else. Do you worry that, along with Mark, that there's an instant gratification, there's a seduction, there's a kind of addiction, a temptation, which just drawing people away from the possibility of putting on that Sunday best and making a really cogent argument in perfect sentences.
I think that's a reasonable worry. I guess an example I often think about is journalism. So journalists typically use various kinds of informalities in their writing for emphasis, particularly the use of fragments. So they might write a complete sentence, but they want to emphasize something, so it set off a dependent clause at the end of it and so forth, in a way that in fifth grade you'd be told, that's a sentence fragment, don't do that. But this is fairly common in journalistic vernacular, just to give one example. And I do notice students imitating that style more than they used to. In other words, it's not that journalists weren't doing this 15 years ago, but for whatever reason, given the nature of the internet and so forth, I feel that it's become a more direct model. So I do see more college students' papers that look like they're imitating a journalistic style than I used to.
So I'm wondering sort of what's wrong with it, because there are sort of two things that you might think are wrong with it, and one of them strikes me as a problem and one of them not. You could think that it's a problem if you're not communicating clearly, but you could also think it's a problem if you're not communicating in a way that, like, signals that you're dressed up. Like, if you communicate clearly in your t-shirt and hoodie rather than in your, like, fancy suit, is that so bad?
I think that's a great question, and I have to say, I ask myself that question a lot because it's not obvious to me it is bad. So 5 years ago, I would have always admonished a student who was using dependent clauses for emphasis as standalone sentences. I would have circled them and said, these are fragments. I'm a little less proactive in that regard right now, precisely because I'm no longer sure there is anything wrong with it. It has achieved a certain kind of generality, you might say, that I'm not sure I can mark it as wrong anymore. But that feels very strange to me as an educator, because again, I'm not sure where these standards are coming from. With regards to the Sunday best, I think that is one of the most complicated issues when it comes to writing style, because there's no doubt, just the same way the moment you lay eyes on somebody, you make 100 snap judgments about them. The first time you read a paragraph somebody's written, you draw 100 conclusions about them. And some of those might be well-founded inferences, but others might be wildly unfair. And so I think we have to be very careful here how judgmental we are about certain features of prose, because we can very quickly come to a lot of conclusions that may or may not be warranted.
That's a really good point. Making the right kinds of distinction, what kind of language we want, what kinds of judgments are reasonable, and what kinds are just completely unfair. But we'll get back to that in the next part of the program. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the death of the sentence with Jan Mieszkowski from Reed College, author of Crises of the Sentence.
Are standards of writing deteriorating, or are they just evolving? What makes for a good sentence anyhow?
Writing with style in the age of emoji, when Philosophy Talk continues. How do I love thee? In Shakespearean sonnet or in memes and eggplant emojis? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Jan Mieszkowski from Reed College, and we're thinking about the death of the sentence.
So Jan, you know, we've been talking a lot about how the internet is changing the way we write, whether, you know, formal writing or just texts. Are we becoming worse writers? Are some of the caller's worries justified? What does it even mean to write well or badly?
Well, that is indeed the million-dollar question, possibly. Maybe $1 million isn't as enough anymore. it's not the $64,000 question, but I think that historically, this has been a very vexing issue politically. Obviously, what is the simplest standard of good writing? People say, well, you want to write clearly, and one might say, well, how could you possibly be unhappy with that? What better standard could there be? And on one level, that's probably true. The problem is that who gets to judge what counts as clear or not clear writing, as with clear or not clear thinking, is a problematic issue.
That seems reasonable. And I would add something else, which I know already that you agree with, that there are times to be clear and times to be enigmatic, right? There are some wonderful, I think, for example, of aphorisms of La Rochefoucauld, that 17th century writer. So he has this fantastic thing, our virtues are mostly just vices in disguise. And it seems initially clear-ish.
You know, but, what does that mean?
But what does it mean? And what does it mean mostly? And who's, I mean, is it my vices? And does that mean that vices could be good because they lead to virtues? And so I love sentences like that, that they're not just fake complicated. They're genuinely complicated, and they get you thinking in cool ways. And so, you know, clarity can be good in some contexts, but maybe this kind of generative, enigmatic feel to it has something going for it as well.
Well, I absolutely agree that a sentence that, and I think the aphorism is a good example, it wins you over in the first instance because you blink and you think, well, that's clever, that must be true. And then you have the second point, which is you say, but wait, what does it mean? And suddenly you're baffled and you almost feel you've been tricked because you somehow assented to something before you understood it. But then you go back and you revisit it. And this, I think this is absolutely right. I mean, a good sentence is a sentence that has to be read more than once, right? A sentence that can be read once and is completely exhausted is probably not that much different from an item on a shopping list or something like that.
I want to ask about things that are almost sentences but not quite that can be read more than once. So there are these things that, like, language log calls snow clones. For instance, the king is dead. Long live the king. That's an example I think you use in your book. But we can also say, like, radio is dead. Long live radio. You can fill in, like, different words for the king. And
so it's like a shape.
Yeah, it's like a shape.
It's a template. Absolutely. No, and I think your examples are nice. I mean, I do write about those as slogans. And sloganized language is very interesting because on the one hand, it's very instrumental. In other words, a slogan is designed to do something, sell you a product or get you to vote for a particular party or something like that. But slogans are also some of the most carefully crafted pieces of language. There's nothing offhand. There's nothing casual about them. So if you actually go and study some of these slogans, you start to realize just how complex they are. Now, what you're referring to is in some sense a staple of Twitter, which is precisely the template or the meme. In other words, you have a form, and the form can be reproduced over and over in different iterations. And I think partly that's just a testimony to something I was saying, you know, back at the beginning about understanding rhythm and syntax as being as important as word choice. In other words, when you construct a really nice syntactic formation, you can recycle it over and over. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Again, I think that's a testimony to sort of the resilience and the generative power of the structure.
I agree. We've got a caller on the line. It's William from Black Hawk, California. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William.
Hey, first-time caller. Good to be here.
Great to have you. What's your comment or question?
I thought that, and this is going to get into semantics a little bit, which is kind of funny a little bit, but I thought that the premise of this discussion was just the slightest bit, likely unintentionally, misleading. I thought that referring to it as the death of a sentence opposed to just a fundamental change of a sentence, it has this really negative connotation to it, this really possibly patronizing to uneducated individuals, possibly a whole lot of different things. You could deconstruct it a million different ways. And there's a lot I want to say with not a lot of time.
Well, I think that's great to be going on with. Thank you so much, William, because I think that gets back to a really important question that Jan was asking a moment ago about these kind of invidious distinctions, invidious defenses of grammatical form, right? So it seems to me that there are ways of celebrating grammatical form that are sort of neutral. Right? I mean, there are certain just regular, everyday coordination principles that help us to understand each other. Nothing necessarily
Subject-verb agreement or something like that.
Yeah, totally fine. And then, you know, we all sort of agree about it and no one's really, it's not a problem. But then there are some that act as kind of exclusion mechanisms, right? Where it's like, oh, you don't know this.
You split your infinitive.
How dare you?
Precisely. Right. I mean, we're not trying to teach students to write in a certain way so that they can get into the right country club or something like that.
Right.
Although, historically, a lot of writing and stylistic standards have been precisely about that.
Precisely. And
as
that's,
we know.
And that's why it's so difficult to tease it apart, right? Like, which things fall into which category?
As the caller was talking, I was thinking the sentence is dead, long live the sentence, the previous conversation. I don't disagree that there's something perhaps slightly overblown about speaking about the death of the sentence. The only thing I would say is that historically, particularly in times of sort of social and political upheaval, people have made extremely strong cases for the, and the word is precisely used, the death of their language. So I'm thinking, you know, many of the things that are said today about the internet and many of the concerns we've been alluding to and enumerating were more or less verbatim used in the early part of the 20th century. Mm. And one of the particular targets there, strangely enough, was newspaper headlines. People thought newspaper headlines were evidence for the way that the language was being used in extremely sloppy, agrammatical, overly ambiguous ways. And again, I could take some of those charges there and simply rewrite them, and you would think that they were about the internet. So this is not a new thing. And as I say, that's one example. You could go back a prior century and a century before that and so forth.
That's fantastic. And of course, the Nietzsche thing. Yeah, so that it's an awkward. And I would say on both sides, that is not just on the side of people lamenting the death of the sentence, but people calling for an overthrow. I want to quote a line from your book that I suspect you probably don't fully mean. Which is this. You say, we may wonder whether true change is conceivable without some change in the hegemonic sentential order. So that's a strong claim, you know, let's kill the king, right? If we won't be free unless we've overthrown the sentence. Is that really your belief?
Historically, avant-garde aesthetic and political movements have always recognized that true change will include at least trying to change the language. I would actually stand by that. I think, as I say, I think you can look at all sorts of different revolutionary events, and it's very clear that part of the revolutionary movement is to try to effect a certain kind of revolution in the language.
But think about,
I
mean,
I don't think
about,
that's an exaggeration.
You know, so think about people who actually have made revolutions, right? Marx and Lenin. They were using grammatical sentences, very powerful ones. Workers of the world unite. Martin Luther King, I have a dream. You know, Audre Lorde. And then on the other side, you got people like Ezra Pound, who are revolutionizing sentence form and lyric form, but he didn't quite get the memo about being on the side of
progress. I just want to break in about Ezra Pound, actually. I remember going to an avant-garde poetry event, and the avant-garde poetry was all from like the first half of the 20th century, which you may have noticed we're no longer in. So I'm a little bit skeptical that breaking down the sentence is all that.
Well, no, I totally agree. I totally agree that this kind of challenge to the sentence does not necessarily mean you're left wing. I mean, you use the example of Ezra Pound. I was thinking, say, of the Italian futurists, so Marinetti and so forth.
Right.
They are usually regarded today as fascist or proto-fascists. They were every bit as, you know, engaged with disrupting norms and conventions than anyone else. So it doesn't follow that it puts you in a certain place on the political spectrum. Just to go back very quickly to your Marx example, though, Marx wrote obsessively about slogans. He also wrote, as a journalist, he also wrote obsessively about the nature of journalistic language. And he was extremely concerned with the extent to which changing the society would or would not involve challenging certain kind of linguistic constraints. That's not to say he wasn't a great writer. He was obviously, with right. Engels, also a great sloganeer, as
precisely.
You've already quoted.
I mean, like
some of the most
actually,
famous slogans.
Right.
Precisely.
I mean, he
precisely.
Brought about great societal change using
absolutely.
Very grammatical senses.
I want to know, like, what kinds of change to the language do you think would make for real societal change or would really be desirable?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question. I think you see some that are going on. And again, what's interesting is it's not quite clear who's driving them. That's always, they always say that's the interesting thing about the language. Language always changes, but no one's quite clear who's in control, who's running the show, as it were. One obvious example is, of course, the way in which people are now seeing it as their prerogative to have a particular pronoun set. Right? That is not something that was going on with anything like the prevalence it is today 25 years ago, but people perceive that very directly as an intervention in a variety of different kinds of ideological debates and so forth. And that's something that's not just happening, you know, at the college level or in some sort of rarefied setting. I mean, that happens in elementary schools now.
That does seem to be a clear case for your point, right? Some degree of change in the language is going to be necessary for certain kinds of societal change.
And I think you could look at a lot of different sort of political events or debates, and you could see that there is a linguistic, there's a verbal facet to them. Maybe we don't always identify it immediately, but it's certainly there, and I think it's a constitutive part of them.
Well, that optimistic note, I think, is a good stopping point for us, but we could talk for hours. It's such a fascinating conversation. I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining us today, Jan.
Well, it's really been my pleasure. I'm very, very happy I could be here. Thanks so much.
Our guest has been Jan Miskowski, who's professor of German and comparative literature at Reed College and author of Crises of the Sentence. So, Ray, what's your thinking now?
I keep coming back to this point about clarity and clear communication, and it just occurs to me that clarity depends partly on who's listening. Like, something could be clear to me and not clear to you. Yeah. And maybe the style...
I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, maybe you should supply your own clear thought.
So it depends who you're talking to, and presumably it depends on what your intention is, right? I mean, maybe you intend to be a little ambiguous, or maybe you want to be clear to some people and not to others.
Or clear about some things and not to others. So what kind of language I use to communicate probably depends on who my audience is and what I'm trying to do, and isn't just some fixed fact.
Yeah, I love that. Well, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community by visiting the website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, or if you're bedeviled by a conundrum in your own life and could use philosophical insight, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Now, running man with text bubble, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, not that long ago, historically, our prose and speech were dictated by the cadences of Shakespeare and the King James Bible, or so conservatives would like us to believe. I suspect that by we I mean Americans, my people, have always been lazy cussing wisecrackers out for the cheap shot and then moving on. I'm as big a fan of Herman Melville as the next guy, but I do have to admit that some of Henry James's sentences, which strolled on a page for ages, it seems, often lost me halfway through. So it's no wonder that people began to turn to Dashiell Hammett for solace in prose, hard-bitten sentences that get on and get off, like grabbing a taxi as opposed to waiting for a train. And, like leisurely ocean voyages, availed by the wealthy few, long letters and fluid prose flowing from heirloom fountain pens went by the wayside. Instead, we got postcards, telegrams, radio, movies, comic books, porn. Staccato replaced the language as time went on. Sentences became catchphrases. I can't believe I ate the whole thing. There you go again. Ich bin ein Berliner. Tear down this wall. Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball. Sentences by others, when attached to images devoid of the context of the original utterance, became punchy alternatives to rational discourse. And then there's lingo, always changing, always fresh, crazy comfy, so fun. All the punchy variations of get it, got it, I get it, she got it, she doesn't get it. Who gets this? Get with it. I'm stoked. I'm pumped. Sentences got shorter and commonly used phrases became replaced by the shorthand we call acronyms, AWOL, SMH, MYOB, AYFKM, pardon my French, LOL. The internet ruined everything, or TIRE. Ignore that sentence at your peril. Not to mention the barrage of memes that serve to replace discussions. If someone online says, for example, vaccines cause autism, you can't really argue with that. It will just unleash a barrage of trolls sending you snake emojis. Instead, what you do is find an animated GIF of Keanu Reeves doing a double take at a puppy. Even if it's not sarcasm, it will seem like it in a way that will go viral in the charming way the internet has of substituting contagion for popularity. And all the while, nothing really changes. Twitter, of course, has replaced the postcard as the medium of choice for giving people pieces of your mind with a character limit per tweet, making the missives even more shorthanded. Mainstream media, or MSM, limps on, but mainly to provide fodder for Twitter and Facebook, which slowly starve them of revenue streams, even as they bleed them dry. Hell of a way to run a railroad, in my humble opinion, IMHO, but nowhere do we find a sentence more emblematic of where we all stand lingo-wise than in these three simple words that popped up a few years back and are now as ubiquitous as awesome, excellent, great, and fantastic. I'm referring to the three simple words we call I know, right? Where do they come from? What do they mean? Is there a declaration? It's usually said in response to something like, boy, that Trump really jumped the shark this time, didn't he? I know, right? So you were agreeing with what's been said with the I know, but then the right is added, which means there's doubt? I think it means that it almost goes without saying. I know, right? I can hardly believe you even had to say that to me. And sooner or later, we will stop bothering. It's all understood, and if it's not, it's not somebody we want in our club anyway, which again could mean one more footstep in the path towards the death of the sentence altogether. Why do we need complete sentences when we have a video loop of Jabba the Hutt winking? I know, right? I gotta go, right?
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I don't like reading.
Do you like books?
I like words and letters. I'm not crazy about complete sentences.